Thank you. I don't feel like a grandmaster somehow. How far away is Cairo, Illinois, from here? Really? Well, it's a very important town in my life. It's a town that indirectly changed my life. When I was 12 years old and living up in Waukegan, which is 30 miles north of Chicago, on the Labor Day weekend in 1932, a carnival came to visit Waukegan. And in this carnival was a man named Mr. Electrico. And he carried with him his own electric chair. And he was electrocuted every night in front of us. And we boys ran down hoping it would really happen, you know. And so on this one night, we all came down to the lake shore, and Mr. Electrico was up on his platform with his electric chair, and they poured 10 billion volts of electricity into his fragile body, and his hair stood up and sparks jumped out of his ears, and he took a sword and passed along the faces of the various boys clustered below the platform, and he came to me, and he put the sword at the end of my nose, and the electricity shot into my head, came out my ears, made my hair stand up. He pointed at me and said, "Live forever!" And I said, "Wow, boy, is that great advice, huh?" Now, how do you do that? How do you do that? Well, I went home that night trying to figure out a way to ask him. I wanted to come back the next day. And I didn't remember till a few years ago what had happened that week. A momentous thing. One of my favorite uncles died that week, and his funeral was being held the next day on Saturday. So Saturday morning, we all went to the funeral home, and we went out to the graveyard to bury my uncle. And on the way back in the car, I looked down at the lake shore, and I saw the tents of the carnival there and the flags and pennants and what have you. And I said to my father, "Stop the car. I've got to get out." He says, "No, we got to get home. We got 30 relatives, 40 relatives waiting for the wake, to darkly celebrate our uncle." I said, "No, I've got to get out here. Stop the car." Well, he stopped the car. He was furious. Here I was, 12 years old. The nerve of this boy of getting out of the car and not going home to be sad with all the relatives. And he drove off in a fury, and he wouldn't talk to me for days after that. And I ran down the hill. Now, what was I doing? I was running away from death, wasn't I? I was running toward that electricity, that life that beckoned me, the promise of living forever. And I got on the carnival grounds, and by gosh, there was Mr. Electrico sitting on his platform as if he were waiting for me, you know? And I ran up to him, and I suddenly got tongue-tied. I didn't know what to say. You can't very well say, "How do you live forever? You know, give me the formula." And I had a magic trick in my pocket, and I thought of that. I pulled it out, and I said, "Mr. Electrico, I don't know how to do this. Could you show me how?" He said, "I'd be glad to do so." So he showed me how to do this trick. And then he looked into my face, and he said, "Would you like to meet all the people in the tent, all the inhabitants of our carnival?" I said, "Oh, could I?" He said, "Come on." So he went over the tent, and he hit it with his cane. And he said, "Clean up your language. Clean up your language, huh?" And he took me in to meet the fat lady and the illustrated man and the skeleton man and other magicians and the trapeze people and the acrobats. And, oh, it was just incredible. I'd never met people like this before. And when that was over, we walked down to the lakeshore and sat on the dunes, and we talked. He talked his small philosophies, and he allowed me to talk my big ones. Because when boys are 12, they're full of large philosophies, aren't they? The world is opening, boy, and it's their oyster, and they can hardly wait. So in the middle of my going on and on about my life and my dreams, I suppose, he looked at me, he says, "You know, we've met before." I said, "Oh, no, sir, this is the very, very first time I've ever talked to you." He said, no. "You were my best friend in France in October of 1918 during the Battle of the Ardennes Forest, and you were wounded in that battle and you died in my arms all those years ago, 14 years ago." And he said, and now here you are back in the world with a new face, a new name, but the soul shining out of your eyes is the soul of my friend from France. Welcome back to the world. Huh? Well, why did he say that? Huh? Isn't it strange? I've wondered all these years since, you know, all these years since, more than 60 years have passed. Why was he so kind? Why did he say his friend's soul inhabited my body? Huh? Well, it might be, I think you've had similar experiences. You meet people just once in a while in life, young or old, and a certain light is shining out of their face. The sort of light that convinces you they want to do everything, and they want to do it right and have wonderful fun doing it. It had to be that must have shown in my face, because I couldn't see my face myself. You look in the mirror and you never catch the real person there, because you always assume a pose. But anyway, he was so wonderfully kind. He gave me his name and address, and he lived in Cairo, Illinois, and which I pronounced Cairo, of course. And I wrote to him in the coming months, and he answered back just once. But I remember when I left the carnival grounds that day, standing by the carousel and listening to the Calliope play Beautiful Ohio, which has remained one of my favorite all-time pieces of music ever in my life. And I stood by the carousel and listened to Beautiful Ohio, and tears poured down my face. I knew that something important had happened in my life, something really important. And it might never happen again, this encounter with Mr. Electrico. I went home, and within 6 weeks, I began to write full-time, and I've never stopped in the last 64 years. All because Mr. Electrico gave me permission to live forever. So Cairo, Illinois is a very important town in my life, and I lost track with him, and the carnival came back the next year, and I ran to the grounds. I could hardly wait to see Mr. Electrico again, and he was gone. Never could find him again. And when Disney did Something Wicked This Way Comes 14 years ago, they said, you want us to find Mr. Electrico? I said, oh my God, you think you could? Chances are small. Too many years have gone by, and I couldn't guess how old he was, maybe in his 30s or 40s when I met him. Chances are he's been dead a long time, but make the search. And by God, Disney went out and searched every carnival and talked to people at Billboard and Variety and the various theater magazines, but they couldn't find him, which made me terribly sad. But at least he's in the film. He's part of it. He plays a different role. He plays a villain in the film, Mr. Dark. But I've written about him in other forms. And my love of carnivals, my love of libraries, they're all intertwined. So that book is full of you people, you know. The major scene in the film and in the book is in a library late at night, the encounter between Mr. Dark and the father of one of the boys, and a wonderful discussion of good and evil, you know, in which I asked myself the question, being raised as a Christian when I was 6 years old until I was 14 in Waukegan, the whole problem of the devil, of evil, of Mephistopheles, of the devil's assistance comes into your mind constantly. Now, why in hell would the devil want your soul in the first place? What would he do with it if he got it? Well, I don't know how many theologians have answered that question. I'm not that well, I haven't done that much research. I'm sure that someone like C.S. Lewis answered it somewhere during the thousands of pages of his wonderful essays. I admire his Screwtape Letters, which I've read many times the last 40 years, but I've never found in the work of any other theological writer an appreciation of the problem. You know, what would the devil do with your soul? Well, I came up with the concept, which I had Mr. Dark explain in the library, that what he does is he lives off suffering. He smells your problems. He inhales the evil that you've done to your own life. The people make each other suffer. We've all known marriages, haven't we, that shouldn't have stayed together, and people stay together and beat up on each other, huh? Physically or mentally, one way or another, and they suffer every day. Well, that suffering is an energy, isn't it? It's a negative energy. That's what the devil wants with your soul. He lives on negative energy. He's attracted to rapes and murders and wars and unhappy marriages, and lonely people. And he lives off that suffering. That's a very good example. And we know people like that, don't we, that live off suffering, that attend funerals every week. Do you have anyone here that does that? When I was a kid, there were two old maids that showed up at every funeral. They didn't know anyone, huh? As long as they're dead, they'd show up. Yeah? So that's a wonderful scene in the library, and it's partly in the film, you know. But almost all of my major novels have libraries in them somewhere, and books. I am the most book-oriented, author-oriented writer that ever existed in this country, huh? There are others that came close, but I've written more about other authors than Mark Twain, or name your favorite author, huh? I've written poetry about Edgar Allan Poe and Emily Dickinson being my mother and father, huh? And I wrote a poem at one time. Emily Dickinson, where are you? Herman Melville called you last night in his sleep, huh? Not a great title? You don't have to read the poem, do you? And I wrote I did a short story called Any Friend of Nicholas Nickleby's is a Friend of Mine, which is in one of my books, and I've done it as a play. It's been on the stage. Fred Gwynn played Charlie Dickens for me in a TV one-hour show a couple of years ago. Wonderful, wonderful. It's a story of how, you didn't know this, did you, that when I was 12 years old, I helped Charles Dickens write A Tale of Two Cities. Huh? That's me, I did it. Huh? And he showed up in my hometown, and he moved into my grandparents' house, and he signed his name in a large, flourishing handwriting. And I read it upside down. I turned to my grandma. I said, Grandma, Charles Dickens. She said, yes, yes, go get the pillows. Yeah. And we go upstairs and we put out the linens and the washcloths and what have you. And my grandma's busy, and Charles Dickens turns to me and he says, Pip. And I say, yes, sir. He says, you don't mind if I call you Pip, do you? I said, no, sir. He says, okay, Pip, take a novel. He says, do you have a pencil? Yes, sir, a Ticonderoga yellow number 2. Okay. Do you have a pad? Yeah, Indian head tablet, nickel tablet. He says, okay, now, Pip, I need a title for this idea of mine. It's a story about Paris and London and back 150 years ago. What would be a good title for something on the French Revolution, huh? I said, he said, put that down, huh? Yeah. And I said, tale, oh yeah, that's excellent, put a tale, huh? A tale of, I write that down, of two cities, excellent, excellent. Tale of Two Cities, chapter 1. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And we're into the novel, huh? And it's a glorious summer. You know, I get up every day, totally alive, huh? Living forever, every morning. Because Mr. Dickens is waiting to dictate his novel to me. And by God, we get through half the summer. Well, at the same time, there's a town barber living and boarding in my grandma's boarding house. And he gets jealous of my relationship with Mr. Dickens. He's the town barber, and I clean the hair off his floor every day and get a nickel for my problems, you know, trouble. And along the way, the town barber gets angry at Mr. Dickens for using up our time and talking too much and dictating his novel to me. And finally he calls Mr. Dickens a fraud, right there at the dinner table. And Charlie Dickens runs upstairs and goes to bed early. And I can't do anything to get him out of his room. Well, finally about 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, I can't stand it anymore. And I go to his room and I knock on the door and I say, Charlie, Charlie, Charlie Dickens. And his voice comes out, he says, Nobody in this room by that name. Charlie Dean. No one by that name in this room, in this house, in this town. And I said, Charlie, let me in. So he lets me in. He gets back in bed, and I stand there, and I look at him. I say, Charlie, who are you? Who are you, Charlie? And he said, well, Pip, I'm a man who could never fit his dream. Wanted to be a writer all my life. Wrote every day of my life. Short stories, novels, novellas, poems, epic poems, obituaries, recipes. I said, weren't any of them any good? He said, not one single line, not one word, all dreadful, boring, you know, terrible, terrible. And he said, finally, after 10 or 15 years of writing, I decided to go on a long journey about 5 years ago on a train. And I took a trunk load of my dears with me, my horrible, ugly children. And I got on the back platform of the smoking car, and at midnight I tossed over manuscript after manuscript, poem after poem, line after line, and my sheets of paper ran down the track behind, you know, leaving a bumper crop of corn a month later, wherever they landed and grew. And I came to the end of my long chuffing journey across the United States, and I got out of the train and left my empty trunk behind and looked in the railroad station gum machine mirror, and I'd grown a sort of beard and goatee and long hair in the meantime, and I looked at myself and I said, my God, Charlie, is that you? Is that you, Charlie Dickens? And my gum machine image said, yes, it is. And I realized that my problem was not writing, but I remembered everything I'd ever read. Remembered all of Plato, all of Socrates, all of Kipling, all of Dickens, what have you. And that wouldn't give me room for creativity, but I could remember every syllable, every syllable. So I made up my mind I was going to start writing the novels of Charles Dickens and become him and move from town to town and lecture and write and lecture and do Dombey and Son here, Great Expectations there, Christmas Carol somewhere else, writing and lecturing, lecturing and writing until in each town when the people finally caught on to me, and it was almost immediate, of course. Then I'd leave town, go on to the next town, and write the next novel, and the next, and the next. So, there you have it, Pip. And tomorrow morning, I gotta leave, because people have caught on to me, and the barber tells them. Maybe they didn't want to catch on. Maybe they liked having me around, but he doesn't, and I can't stay here now. I said, Charlie, you can't do that. We haven't finished the novel, We haven't finished A Tale of Two Cities. And, you know, he packs, you know. And we walk down the railroad station. There's supposed to be a train pulling out around 1 o'clock. And I'm frantic, just frantic, you know. And we pass the library. And I say, Charlie, come here, just a second. And the train's beginning to pull in down below. I said, Charlie, listen here by the window. Listen, hear that? And he hears scratch, 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 over, scratch, scratch. He said, that's fine penmanship, And someone in there writing a poem. Oh, yes, I could not stop for death, And so and then he said, take me inside, Pip. And in the meantime, the train's in the station, you know, and we go up and we look back in the stacks, and way back there's a woman with a face like a gently lit lamp, like a candlelit face and soul, And he calls into the shadows. He says, Emily, Miss Emily. And Emily Dickinson comes out of the stacks. Well, I tell you, I introduce them to each other. I get very emotional at this because I love this story. And I introduce them, and Charlie stays on. And I finish A Tale of Two Cities with him. And then the last day of summer, we run down to the station, and I throw rice at them and say, happy wedding day, Miss Emily, happy wedding day, Charlie. And they go off on the train, you know. And letters start coming back all through September, October. Get a whole clutch of letters. Some of them I haven't opened yet. I've been waiting for the right moment. And on an October evening, with raking up the leaves, my grandpa's out in front with me, and I begin to open the letters. And he says, Dear Pip, Charlie and I are in Kankakee tonight, Sweetwater tomorrow, up in Wisconsin, Madison the day after. 2 weeks from now, we'll be doing Dombey and Sons and over in Michigan somewhere. Then we'll be out in Colorado, and we're writing and lecturing and writing, Pip. And I've never been so happy in my life. You know, being mad together is wonderful, but being mad alone was nothing. You know? So we travel. We travel and write. I'm writing my poems. He's writing his stories. And someday we may come back to Greentown, and we'll tell you ahead. And if you come down to the station to greet us, that will be wonderful. But if in the meantime you've grown up and grown too old and don't show, I'll understand that too, you know, because you were very special to our life. Charlie sends his best to you and love. And P.S., he said that your grandpa reminds him of Plato. Huh? take care, Pip, signed Emily Dickinson. Well, I sit there in the October night with the leaves falling and my grandpa raking the leaves and the wind blowing softly, and I finally say, you know, Grandpa, I don't believe they're crazy. And my grandpa says, neither do I, Pip, neither do I. End of story. So you see, now the reason I write all these things is because when I graduated from high school, I lived in a very poor family. My dad had been in and out of work for 8 or 9 years. Most of you here today don't know what a real depression is. Some of you are old enough to remember some of that. But it went on forever. You know, it started in 1929, went on up until 1942, when the World War II cured it, but it wasn't cured ahead of that. They tried, but they didn't know what to do. So when I graduated from high school, my family was on relief, getting food from the government, rice, sugar, flour, a few other things, as I recall. I got a job selling newspapers on a street corner. My brother went in the CCC camp, Civilian Conservation Corps, where he made, I don't know, $30 a month, most of which he sent home, because we had nothing. I snuck in the movies all the time. I couldn't pay my way in. I got to know all the managers of all the cinemas in Los Angeles, and I'd go hang around and make myself useful with something, run for a newspaper, and got to see all the movies one way or another. But in the meantime, I couldn't go to college, which is just as well. You can't learn writing in school. You can learn certain techniques, you can learn certain shortcuts if you have a teacher that tells you what the shortcuts are, to be yourself, huh? To have fun, to explode every day and pick up the pieces at noon, huh? So I went to the main library downtown LA and spent 2 or 3 days a week there for 10 years. And I went through every room, some rooms a long time. I stayed forever in the room of literature and essays, the room of novels and short stories, and the room of plays, huh? I read my way through all the major plays of the world and all the major poetry, all the major essays. Those are all packing yourself with metaphors, huh? And in the certain science rooms and what have you. So at the end of 10 years, I graduated from the library, huh? And the president of a university in California heard this story a couple of years ago, and during my lecture, ran out and got a cap and gown and a diploma and came back and officially graduated me from the library. So I'm one of you. I'm one of you. All the women in my life have been librarians and booksellers and English teachers. Huh? And that's my wife. I met her in a bookstore in L.A. 50 years ago, and we got married 49 years ago. Best thing ever happened to me. Well, we had no money. All of my short stories were selling to the pulp magazines for a half cent a word or a penny a word. Huh? The Martian Chronicles sold to Thrilling Wonder Stories and Amazing Stories and Planet Stories for 2 cents a word. You know, I didn't get rich, did I? Huh? But I was writing a novel without knowing it that was going to be around for a long time. I just never dreamt that today the darn thing is still around, huh? But the library was so important. It was my home. I would wander around the stacks with those little slips of paper you write items on, except I was writing short stories on them. It's not easy to write a short story on those little memo slips, so I used dozens of them, you know. And the librarians got so that when I came in, they'd hand me a whole stack of these things. But it was just natural that I would educate myself in the library. And as a result, I have a better education than most people, you know. Because when you've read all the major poetry of the world, when you read all the short stories and all the plays, boy, you've got a real education. Plus, I tell people to read as many essays as they can, young writers who start out, and in dozens of fields, architectural fields, city planning fields, English history, French history, what have you, all kinds of things. And don't take other people's lists in with you. Just go and discover for yourself and run amok in the stacks, huh? And sure, occasionally you get a suggestion from someone, but it's very hard to guess other people's needs. Occasionally, when we talk to a friend and they talk and talk and talk, and you finally say, hey, the way you talk, you need John Collier, you need Kipling or whatever, huh? You can make that suggestion. But I try not to do that very often, just certain books on occasion, like the works of Lauren Eisley, the wonderful scientist who was head of the Department of Anthropology in Pennsylvania a few years ago. But I try not to make lists for people and to tell them to run amok in the stacks. Back about 46 years ago, I couldn't afford an office. We had two children at home suddenly, wonderful girls, and I worked out in the garage behind our house. We couldn't afford a car, so it was my office out and back. But my daughters would come and tap on the back window and say, Daddy, come out and play. Well, of course, Daddy went out and played, huh? And no stories got written, huh? And I decided I finally had to get an office somewhere, and I was wandering around UCLA, and I heard typing in the basement room of the main library. And I went down to investigate. By gosh, there was a typing room down there where for 10 cents a half hour, you could rent a typewriter and move into this room with 12 students. They didn't know who I was. I didn't know who they were, huh? So I moved in there for about a year. Went over there every day and typed and put a dime in the machine and shoved it in and typed like crazy for half an hour and then ran upstairs to get more dimes, huh? But in 9 days, I wrote Fahrenheit 451 in that typing room, huh? I did a short form first, 25,000 words. But the great thing is writing a book like Fahrenheit, which has to do with book burning and book learning and what have you, is the fact that the library was right above me and I could run upstairs between sessions and touch the books and smell the books and open the books, strange books I'd never seen, looking for quotes to put in my novel, certain short form things, semi-haiku, two lines from Pope, some of his fabulous quotes, and then run back to the typewriter. Again, I hyperventilated all day. And I was exhilarated and finally published the novel in 1950 in a science fiction magazine. And then I added 25,000 more words again 2 years later and got a publisher. And it was during the McCarthy period. A lot of people were afraid. I never did understand that. I thought he was a fraud and a fake, and that if you blew hard, he'd fly away in the wind, which is what finally happened, of course. But it was difficult selling Fahrenheit to a magazine. We wanted to get some extra money for it. Our three-part serial ran the first three issues of his magazine, which was Playboy, huh? So whatever you think of Playboy, I helped start it. And I'm not sorry. I'm only sorry it wasn't around when I was 14, right? So, Hugh Hefner, every once in a while I see him. I saw him at a party last year, and he came up and he says, "Thank you for being there when it counted, huh?" He remembered what I'd done to help him start the magazine. Of course, the rest is history. So, the story has been around. It's still around now. I'm doing a new screenplay of it. Truffaut did a version of it 30 years ago, which was quite nice, but left a lot of things out. Yeah, a lot of things I thought were important. And he miscast the role of Clarice McClellan, the girl next door. She's supposed to be 16, and he had Julie Christie play that role, and she was totally wrong. So I've written a new script, and Mel Gibson has bought it, and we hope it will be produced next year, that he will direct and star in it. Huh? And join the church, everyone, and light a candle for me. Thank you. Well, you never know what the studios are going to do. You know, you hand things in, and months go by, nobody calls. In this age of communication, have you noticed? Everyone feels like a Jewish mother. No one calls, huh? No one calls. Fax machines, computers, the internet, the superhighway of information. It's a ridiculous time that we live in. All these ways of communicating and very little communication, huh? Very little communication. And the interesting thing about Fahrenheit 451, I wrote it to prevent a future. Huh? Unfortunately, a lot of it has come about. We don't burn books, we just don't educate children anymore. Huh? So if you don't educate children to read and write in kindergarten in the first grade, that's where it all starts and ends. By the end of the first grade, you shouldn't have to worry about teaching reading and writing anymore. Huh? Used to be done all the time by all the teachers that I ever knew when I was growing up. Huh? It doesn't take money, huh? Just a little willpower, a little intelligence, and then they're ready for the second grade. Well, people come out of the ninth grade nowadays, they come out of high school and they can't read. So you don't have to burn books, do you? Because they don't read them and they don't buy them. Now, that's not true for everyone, thank God. So I'm going to talk to a group of 5,000 teachers of gifted children down in Texas next month, and I'll say to them what I've just said to you, you know, and they're on my side. I don't attack the whole system, because that way you alienate everybody, huh? But I attack the first grade and kindergarten, and they're not doing their work, and our whole civilization is going down the tubes as a result, huh? And I try to warn. Get the teachers on my side, the second grade teachers, the ninth grade teachers, the high school teachers, to attack the first grade and say, you must deliver forth bright children, huh? There's no excuse for not reading, huh? And they say, yes, I get a standing ovation from these teachers, because they know I care, and that this is the answer. A lot of the answers to our drug problems, our prison problems, our violence is in our educational system, isn't it? If a boy gets to be 12 years old and 14 and he can't read, he's going to become a dropout, he's going to be a drug mover, he's going to be a rapist, he'll be a criminal, he'll be anything except right, because there's nothing in here. Now, if you put something in there, you've got a toy shop in there, something to work with and to play with and to use. To apply yourself to the future. We have 1 million people in prison in the United States today, and hardly one of them knows how to read. Does that tell you something? I think it should. Now, what I'm suggesting isn't a cure-all, but I think it sure would make a hell of a lot of difference if we paid attention to the first grade. Then that would help all of you librarians, too, and all the bookstores. Look at the sort of books that are being sold in the bookshops. Look at the kind of shows that are on television. Look at your local TV news, huh? Everywhere I go, I tell people from now on, that applies to all of you here today too, you're never to look at local television news ever again. Yeah. Because it's all crud, isn't it? It's 15-second obituary bites of news, huh? All bad. Funerals you don't want to go to, murders you didn't commit, rapes you had nothing to do with, AIDS you don't want to catch, huh? Yeah. All these good things, huh? And they feel the. There have been a lot of articles in magazines and newspapers the last year about this feeling of ennui in the American people. The world is coming to an end. We're no good. That all comes from a local TV news. You watch 1,000 nights of bad news, you got to be convinced the American character is horrible, huh? But we're not, huh? We're still the greatest nation in the history of the world, huh? Greatest nation still. We're still taking in, the last 40 years, every year, 500,000 immigrants a year. That's a damn good record, isn't it? We don't take enough credit. All this talk of immigration recently should have to do with illegals, of course. But we haven't even educated the legals that we brought in and made citizens. And that applies to the immigrants and applies to every child in our educational system. I never wanted to put any of my daughters in a private school. I don't believe in private schools. But you're forced into it if your educational system turns your children into dummies, huh? If they don't educate. So one by one, I pulled my daughters out and put them in private schools. And now my grandchildren, I have 8 grandchildren, and one by one, we're pulling them out of public schools and putting them in private schools. Don't want to do it, huh? But the public schools are not doing the work. We should have a massive effort. Concentrate our will on this, huh? And you don't need money for it. We're putting the money in the wrong places. It doesn't do any good up in the fifth grade. It takes 10 times as long to educate someone to read up there, or in high school, or when they get out of high school. My wife teaches at SC University. She teaches technical French, huh? But it drives her bats when 19, 20-year-old students show up who don't know English grammar. This late in time. So we have newspapers like USA Today. We have People Magazine, huh? I mean, stupid, idiotic, horrible magazines and newspapers. They have a semblance of intelligence. They pretended thinking. You have shows like Jeopardy, huh? It's fun to tune in and test your memory, but that's not intelligence, huh? That's not thinking. You think you're thinking, but who cares if you know the names of all the capitals of all the states? Who cares if you know who's buried in Grant's tomb, huh? And that's what it's just factoids. Factoids. Has nothing to do with putting two metaphors together to make a third metaphor. That's the job of the librarian and the teacher, to teach people to fill their heads with so many different kinds of metaphors, not just facts, of collisions of ideas from poetry, from Greek mythology. My mind is full of stuff I began poking into my eyeballs when I was 3 years old. I've seen every film ever made, so I have an education in all the major films, including the bad ones, huh? Starting with The Hunchback of Notre Dame when I was 3, Phantom of the Opera when I was 5, Lon Chaney became my hero, huh? When he died in 1930 when I was 10, it was the end of the world. I thought he was the greatest actor that ever acted, huh? So you put away all these images from films, then you put away all the metaphors from poetry, good, bad, and indifferent, and you put away images and metaphors from the great essays of the world, the great plays of the world, the great novels, all the short stories. Jesus, you know, when you get all these things in your head, then you can begin to think about something, huh? You're not just a fact collector. And that's what our magazines and newspapers have become. They're presenting you facts, but they don't tell you what to do with them. Or if they do, they tell you the wrong things to do, huh? They want to politicize these things, and to hell with that. So I tell people, don't watch the local news, because it's all crud, huh? You can watch Jim Lehrer every night. He's intelligent, he's informative, and he's non-political. And you can watch David Brinkley on Sunday, good show. And you have people with labels on them, so you can tell who in hell you're looking at. And you can watch the McLaughlin Group if you can understand them. So, but the... This pretense. I went to a gathering of editors and publishers of all the major newspapers and magazines in the United States in Phoenix a couple of years ago. And I thought, what shall I tell them? What can I say to them when I get up? So I went to the nearest magazine rack and I picked out 10 magazines and carried them up on the platform with me. And I held them up one by one. I held up Good Housekeeping. I said, I defy you to find the articles in this damned magazine. And I flapped the magazine. It's all ads, you know. I had a poem in there a couple of years ago. Couldn't find my damn poem. And I called Good Housekeeping and I said, where the hell is my poem? And they said, just a moment. And they said, came back, this is page 160, opposite the Lysol ad. I said, thanks a lot. So I said, Good Housekeeping is all ads, to hell with it. And I threw it at the editors. Huh? And then I picked up Vanity Fair, and then I showed them Vogue and Harper's Bazaar. I said, find the articles. You can't find them, huh? Get all these ads. And then, my God, Forbes magazine and Fortune, two of the best magazines ever published in our country. Good articles that are helpful if you could find them, huh? You got a half page here, and you got a full page, another part of the magazine, but they should be a two-page spread, shouldn't it, here and there, of an article? Instead of one page on the left, it shouldn't be on the left, it should be on the right, huh? So I threw Fortune at them, I threw Forbes at them. I said, for shame, huh? And then I held up Time magazine, I said, people too, huh? And it's just as bad because they had a section, I don't know if it's still there, I hope not. Up front, they had book reviews that were 18 words long. Mind breakers, huh? Yeah. Some of them were really hard to read, 32 words for a ballet, huh? 47 words for a play, 52 words for a movie, huh? And all these little snippets, huh? Look through, when you leave here today, you've already done this anyway, and you got most of the magazines here in the library, I'm sure. But just look through the best magazines, it's all snippets. Front and back, they got these little obituaries to ideas, huh? Because they're afraid they're going to lose your attention. And the more they pander to your losing attention, the more you lose your attention. It's a bore, huh? What we'd like to get, there's my wife and I get commentary every issue, the American Scholar, two of the best magazines still around. And thank God you can find all the articles in both of them. But in the latest commentary and last spring, they had a huge series of articles on Charles Darwin and Darwinism and the crisis in thought about what we think of Darwin now, all these years later, by various brains all around the world in the United States, pro and con, huh? Because it's the theory's never been proven. We have a feeling it has been, but it hasn't, huh? So we're all curious at our place here in the world. You know, what are we doing here? How did we get here? The jumps between species are too huge. They can't be explained. Every time they try to explain something like that, they say it's a sport. It's a genetic leap. It's a genetic sport. Well, that doesn't answer it, does it? Huh? How in hell did the caterpillar become a butterfly? Huh? There had to be some point in history where a new species of worm came along that looked at this guy and dreamt flying, huh? It sounds like Lamarck, doesn't it? You know, that's what Lamarck said, that the giraffe dreamt himself a longer neck, and genetically over a period of centuries, the neck occurred. Well, there's no way of telling what happens to the genetics of the body secretly when we think things. We know we can control our body up to a point during illness, that the love of friends, our regard for ourselves helps us to cure ourselves, huh? Not all the time, but quite often, love is an unguent, huh? Is a tonic. And that affects what goes on within the body, and we can't see it. We don't even know why aspirin works. We know it does. We can describe some of the things it does in the body, but we don't know why that happens, huh? Why this drug instead of that one, huh? What causes the heart of the fetus to start beating, we don't know. It's a mystery. It's all locked in there. one moment there's this little organ in there that's alive but dead, huh? Alive but dead. And suddenly some mechanism within the genetics says, start beating, huh? And that little heart starts beating and life begins. But we know nothing of this, nothing, huh? And nothing of how we got on the world and what we're doing here. This is a peculiar species with the ability to see and know what we see, huh? So in that, these two issues of commentary, you got something to read, you got something to talk about, you have ideas, huh? Maybe you won't come to any final conclusions. Maybe you'll come down on one side and come down on the other. And you have articles on abortion, of course, constantly the last few years, and will never be solved. It will never be solved, huh? But we Americans love to solve things, don't we? Gotta have answers, gotta have final answers. But there are no final answers to some things. So what you do is you just roll along between these things and pick up things in the American Scholar commentary, a few other magazines where they trust you to have a few conniption fits on occasion, huh? So, but of the other magazines, it's very dismaying to go by the average magazine sales place where they got 300 magazines there and not an idea in one of them, huh? So my Fahrenheit 451 civilization has come about. And you don't have to worry about people reading because they're not reading, so you don't have to burn the books, huh? So we got to get active, very active. Everywhere I go, I say the same things I'm saying to you because I'm protecting your future as well as my own. Otherwise, we're all out of business, aren't we? Or you'll have nothing but Judith Krantz books on the shelves, huh? Now, if that doesn't scare the hell out of you. So, I'm here to scare you a little, okay. Anyway, it's been glorious fun working in my field. And of course, we've moved into a science fiction age, huh? The main point about teaching boys especially, see, girls are superior students. They start out superior and they get all the good grades, and this is true of all the generations in the history of the world. Girls are the brighter sex, and all through school up until a certain point, somewhere around the 7th, 8th grade, 9th grade, boys begin to catch up, if they're going to catch up. Now, if you don't catch them, if you don't teach them to read, they become the criminal element. And so it's more important that boys get educated than girls, because boys are murderers. Hmm? Girls don't murder, girls don't rape, girls don't beat up on people. They may become drug experts, huh? But they're not dangerous to our society the way an uneducated boy is. So we've got to really, and the way to catch a boy is with science fiction, huh? Sorry to blow my own horn, but no, I'm not sorry. What am I saying? Because it's full of ideas, huh? Philosophies, small ones, large ones. What are these machines doing to us? How can we use the machines? Fascinating. You hook a boy on that boy, and he's in there forever, huh? In there forever. That's what happened to me when I was 8 years old and saw the first science fiction magazines. My God, they were so beautiful, beautiful. With the architectures of the future that I wanted to live in, huh? And then when the World's Fair was built in Chicago in 1933, I went down and I walked through the world of the future, and I didn't want to go home at night. It was so gorgeous, huh? So, and I was hooked forever on the future, and I collected Buck Rogers, and I recognized the future, the very first panel that I saw on the New Sun in Waukegan in October of 1929, when I was 9 years old, huh? I never stopped being excited after that. Buck Rogers and Mr. Electrico and the World's Fairs, huh? And I knew I had a chance of living forever then. I had a goal to go to. I could leave my mark somewhere. And I had an encounter with some virtual reality people in Los Angeles a year and a half ago. A lot of these people, special effects people, work for the studios, and they do miraculous things. You know, the Schwarzenegger films are brilliantly technically made, huh? You destroy someone and they melt back up and become themselves again, huh? just like certain politicians keep coming back. You know? And I saw a lot of these films before I lectured to them, and I said, you know, we have a problem here. You do beautiful work, brilliant work, huh? I admire what you do, but it's brainless, huh? You have no brain in your head, you have no heart in your body, you have no soul around the heart. For God's sake, this is all stupid stuff you're doing. Beautiful but stupid, huh? And I said, go find someone to put a brain and a heart and a soul into your virtual reality things. I said, what you're doing now, I come out of one of your films, I've spent 2 hours, it's a Chinese dinner, and an hour later I'm hungry, huh? Because you haven't got the smallest idea of why you're playing with the fireworks. I said, I love fireworks as much as anyone. But when the fireworks are over at midnight on the 4th of July, and the wind blows, the sky is empty, huh? The fireworks are meaningless, except as things of beauty, and I love them. But it doesn't help me with my philosophies, huh? It doesn't help me. I said, now go find some writers. Hire me, for God's sake. So by God, the next week, Doug Trumbull, who did the special effects on Close Encounters of a Third Kind, called me and hired me to work with Buzz Aldrin, the astronaut, on a project to go into the museums and some of the world fairs of the world during the next few years. And we'll see. I tried to put a brain, a heart, and a soul into his machinery, huh? Yeah. A good example of a science fiction film that has a concept, that has a soul, that has a heart, is Close Encounters of a Third Kind, you know? The film has plenty of flaws. It's too long, huh? I told Spielberg that when I first met him. I met him the day after the preview. I called him and I said, introduced myself, and I said, can I come out to the studio for 5 minutes? He said, why? I said, I want to tell you I love you and that you're a genius. He says, come out. So I went out to the studio, and I walked into his office, and he said, how do you like your film? I said, what do you mean? He said, that's your film. He said, if you hadn't made It Came From Outer Space when I was a kid, I would never have done this, because some of the certain ideas somewhat similar in both films. But the thing about the film is this, that is transcendent and caused me to weep watching it, is the encounter between two worlds, you know? It's like the fabulous painting on the Sistine Chapel ceiling of God and Adam, huh? And God reaches down this way, and Adam reaches up this way, and the spark leaps the gap, huh? Two halves of the cosmos, the universe, the mystery of being, huh? These creatures from across the universe somehow have landed, and we touch them, and we weep with joy because we have a chance meeting them to live forever, huh? And if they don't do it, we must do it. That's why I did a speech with the astronauts 2 weeks ago to reaffirm our desire to go back to the moon and to go to Mars, huh? Very important. And I've been on various TV shows the last month because of the Martian rock, you know, which was, they overdid it on a lot of shows, you know, and I use it as a catapult. We use this to cause a resurgence of faith in the space effort, huh? Because if we make it, if we colonize the moon and go on to Mars and move on out through the solar system, sometime in the next 1,000 years, we can make it out to Alpha Centauri and perhaps farther, huh? At the speed of light or half the speed of light, 4 years or 8 years, whatever, huh? And if we make it, we're going to give ourselves another 1,000,000 years or so of life, huh? We can live what appears to be forever. Why? Because we are worth saving, huh? With all our faults, with all our faults, with all our wars, with all our indifference, with all our stupidity, and with Shakespeare as accompanist, and Emily Dickinson, and Rudyard Kipling, and Charlie Dickens, and Alexander Pope, huh? All these good companions we will take with us, huh? So the gift of life has been given us. We don't quite know why, except we represent the life force, and we must be beholden to the gift. If someone gives you a gift, you must use it, huh? You people are using your gift very well. You're helping to pass the light on. Very important thing to do. And to have that gift and not to use it, I've known writers that twice as talented as I will ever hope to be who haven't used the gift, and I beat up on them all the time. Huh? I said, for shame, for shame, not using the gift that God gave you. Huh? So the space travel is an immense movement. It's a religious activity, not a technological feat, not a military wonder, not a political toy. It's a religious endeavor with us to try to relate ourselves to the universe, to try to figure out the mystery. And we never will figure out the mystery because we're part of it. But we take this gift then of ourselves and our cognizance. The invention of the eye caused us to see the stars. And once seeing them, we couldn't let them alone. Huh? So we're moving out in space for your children's children's children to live forever. That's what it's all about. Nothing else. Nothing else. Huh? And I try to say that when I go on the TV shows and on the lecture tour. So you see, I'm very deeply involved with all these ideas. And I get after the virtual realists and the technical people. And I'm fighting the good fight with the studios all the time when they try to make films of mine and then ruin them in the process. And then, by God, I do them over again. I keep the rights, and I've done the Martian Chronicles over on the Ray Bradbury Theater during the last 6 years, and I've done it right this time because NBC didn't do it right in the first place. And Truffaut's Fahrenheit is very good, but there's still some missing pieces, so put those together. Now, it's about an hour here, and I think maybe one or two questions, and then I'll sign books for anyone that wants to have something signed. Do we have some questions here? You see, I've stunned you. Yeah.
Along with living forever and traveling across the universe, do you feel that the body will become obsolete? I mean, in light of coming back from 6 months in space and your bones lose minerals and the fluid in your body rises up into your chest, all these physiological things sort of point me toward the idea that the body will become obsolete.
Boy, I hope the body doesn't become obsolete, or I'm not going to talk to Bo Derek ever again.
You just talked about how it's so important to start reading at first grade. It's so important to start writing. Those same things are applicable to first graders using their bodies. The paper's full of stories about obesity and children not being able to pass minimal physical tasks.
Yeah.
To me, that's points in that direction.
Well, we're going to solve these problems one by one. That's why they're going out there. This lady that just came back from space and all the other people who spent time up there, we're measuring things. We'll probably figure out ways of building spaceships that we don't know nothing about, and sort of dietary programs we can go on. I can't possibly guess at the solutions, but somewhere along the line, we'll solve these problems as we solved the problem of going into space in the first place. We couldn't go to the moon 40 years ago because we didn't have a heat shield to put on the projectile when it returned to Earth. It would burn up. And everyone said, well, we'll never invent something that will not completely self-destroy. Well, we did, and the heat shield on the landing craft. So we solved that problem. We've solved a lot of problems. And I have a feeling that at the end of 30 years from now, we'll have a lot of the basic problems answered about the human body in outer space. I'm positive of that. So yes, in back.
Yeah, you've given us many good tips for young writers and such. What other tips can you give to other science fiction writers in the future?
Well, you want tips, right?
Yes.
Some ideas. Well, excuse me, but I've written a book on this. It's called Zen and the Art of Writing. Do you have it here in the library somewhere? Here's a copy right down here. There's another one back there. What am I bid? And if you read this, it teaches you how to explode. See, there are a lot of books on writing that are too technical, and that's the... A lot of people try to teach you to become a writer by imitating. Well, you got to go through that phase for a while, of course, when you're a teenager. But then you have to break free of that, and you have to begin to delve into this stuff that you are, huh? All the memories you have of living from the hour of your birth. I remember being born. I'm very unusual. I was a 10-month baby, which means I was born cognizant. I could see when I came forth. That's very unusual for a child. But the fact that I stayed in the womb an extra month caused all my senses to be heightened, developed. So I remember the moment of birth and the nightmares that I had in my crib the next 3 or 4 days, remembering being born. So all this stuff from the moment of birth to now is in you. You just haven't tested to bring it out. Plus all that you've learned in school, all that you've learned in the library, and all these metaphors are collecting around, and you begin to find ways to bring them out, to word associate, and drag them out one at a time. Make lists of things that you hate and write about them. Or make lists of people you want to kill and kill them. Make lists of things that you love and love them in stories. That's what writing is all about. So if you like science fiction and you love space travel, then you write. Time and again, I've gone to the typewriter and said, well, what would it be like if a rocket ship exploded in space and all the people on board were tossed out to the infinities of space, 8 men have to separate, have to say goodbye. They have only limited radio contact for half an hour. They don't have their power packs on. They can't project themselves back together. And one of them is going to fall in the sun. One of them is going to hit Earth. One of them is going off toward Mars. One of them is heading out toward the one of the outer planets with some planetoids. It's a story called Kaleidoscope. And I've done it as a play. I've done it as a short story. And I've seen it many times on the stage in high schools and grade schools. And it works because it's about human beings faced with the problem of saying goodbye forever. Most of us don't have a chance when we die of saying goodbye. We hope we can, just very briefly, to our very best friends and loved ones. But in this story, I started with the premise of what would it be like to explode in outer space and have a chance to speak briefly. And boy, does the play work, with every audience. So this is the sort of stuff you're looking for. The Martian Chronicles wrote itself because I dared let 4 different expeditions land, not knowing what would happen to them, you see. I didn't write the stories. The stories wrote me, out of my guts, out of my need. I wrote several murder mysteries. It took years to accumulate enough knowledge to release myself and relax and have fun doing it. You can't plan things. A lot of people talk about, do you plot a thing ahead? Of course you can't, It's like my talking to you today. I have no notes. I never knew what I was going to say next. I have varieties of things I say to different audiences. A library, an audience of librarians is very special because you have knowledge in many, many fields, and I can be all over the place and talk certain names and know that you'll react. But that's the way you must write. So I wrote most of the Martian Chronicles, making lists of things. And then over the years, I made lists of things in northern Illinois, dandelions, night porches, sound of a locomotive train at 3 a.m, the loneliest sound in the world, wailing by in the middle of the night. And that's a funeral train come to get me, Because one of my favorite cousins died when I was 7 in northern Illinois. And for weeks after that, the 3 a.m. train crossing the prairie in northern Illinois would wail its whistle, and it was coming to get me. Because people died in those days, you see. My generation, we had no medicines. Penicillin, sulfanilamide were invented when I was 19 years old. So my sister died when I was 7. My brother died before I was born. Various uncles and aunts. This is the great influenza epidemic of 1918. I have an uncle buried in France there. Millions died in 2 or 3 weeks all over the world. Terrible, terrible truth. So out of all this stuff, you begin to write. I lived in Ireland for almost a year when I wrote Moby Dick for John Huston. And friends of mine said, when are you going to write a screenplay? And when are you going to write a mystery? And I said, well, I'm not going to write about Ireland because I'm not seeing anything. I'm living here, but I don't see a thing. Well, how stupid can you get? I was walking in the rain every night in Dublin. Huh? And it rains 40 nights a month in Dublin. Huh? Now, how the hell they do that, I don't know. And I knew every candy butcher. I knew every beggar outside of the hotels and knew some of the actors and some of the writers and the poets. And when I got home, for about a year, one of these voices spoke to me. And this voice said, in the middle of the night, 40 years ago, this voice said, "Hooray, darling." I said, "Who is it?" He said, "Ah, God, you know, it's Nick, your cab driver. Remember all those nights driving back and forth from Kilcock to Maynooth to Dublin? Do you remember that with the witch's place over here? And here's where they raised the priests to educate the people of the world. Remember all that, Ray?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Would you mind putting it down?" And I wrote the first story, the first night of Lent, and then another, and then another, and then another, and discovered I was a great green sponge. I sucked in the whole damn country, huh? Along with knowing Sean O'Casey, huh? And admiring George Bernard Shaw, the great Irish writer. We don't think of him as Irish most of the time, but he was, huh? And all the other Irish, Liam O'Flaherty, a lot of wonderful Irish writers and poets. Yeats, incredible, incredible. Been going back through again recently. So you got all this stuff in you, and you haven't even begun to pull it out, you see. So you word associate dandelions, tennis shoes, huh? And say, what do I know about tennis shoes? What do I know about dandelions, making dandelion wine? And it all comes back, huh? And the more you write, the more you can write. And after a while, you're finding out about yourself all the time. Not for a market out here or a market out there. Not for political reasons. Not for aesthetic reasons to please your friends. To hell with that, huh? You got to please you and your ganglion, huh? And have fun every day. Writing should be fun. It shouldn't be a serious, over-technical activity. If you've learned your grammar, if you learn how to construct sentences, you know, then you're ready to explode, huh? And that's what I try to teach people. Now I'll end. Well, we'll be out of here by 5, okay? let me make a point here, and then I'll. You ask your question. Yeah, okay. Which story is this? Oh, yes. Well, my wife suggested that. We were out walking one night, and she quoted that poem to me. And I was so taken with the poem, I said, my God, I've got to do something with that. And I went home and wrote the short story that night, coupled with a picture I'd seen in the newspaper of a Japanese house with the shadows of the people burned on it by the atom explosion. It's a terrible, terrible picture. So you can thank that dear poet, and you can thank my wife for quoting it to me. Now, let me make a point here. There's so much I've done that I've had such a fascinating time with. People along the way said, when are you going to write a screenplay? And I said, when John Huston asks me, huh? And I knew exactly who I wanted to work for. I loved The Maltese Falcon. I saw it 20 times over the years, and it still holds up. It's on the air all the time. If you haven't seen it recently, go rent it and look at it. It's a brilliant piece of filmmaking. And finally, I had a chance to meet John Huston and turned it down because I wasn't ready yet. I'd only published one book, and I wanted evidence of my love. If you're going to meet a famous person and you want to work with them, you got to prove yourself. You can't just go up and say, hire me, you know, here I am. Yeah. And so I published The Martian Chronicles and The Illustrated Man and Dark Carnival, and I said, now I'm ready. And I got my agent to call John Huston. I had dinner with him. I gave him my books. I said, it's very simple. I love you and what you do. And if you like these books half as much as I appreciate your work, someday call me. Huh? And he wrote me from Africa. He was doing The African Queen with Katie Hepburn and Bogart. And he said, yes, you're right. Someday we'll work together. I don't know on what, but someday. Well, 2 years went by. We corresponded twice. And he came back home in August of 1953 and called me, and I went over to his hotel, and he invited me in the room, and he put a drink in my hand, sat me down, and he looked at me and said, "Well, Ray, what are you doing during the next year?" And I said, "Not much, Mr. Houston, not much." He said, "Well, kid, tell you what, how'd you like to come, live in Ireland, and write the screenplay of Moby Dick?" I said, "Gee, Mr. Houston, I've never been able to read the damn thing." Well, he'd never heard that before. And he said, "Well, I tell you what, Ray, why don't you go home tonight? Read as much as you can. And come back tomorrow and tell me if you'll help me kill the white whale." So I went home that night and I said to my wife, "Pray for me." And she said, "Why?" I said, "Because I've got to read a book tonight and do a book report tomorrow." Well, what I did was surf the book, huh? 900 pages, you can't read it. But I surfed the metaphors and discovered a similar soul like myself. Because the early American writers in the 19th century, Washington Irving, Poe, Melville, Washington, and all the other writers wrote metaphors. They wrote fairy tales. They wrote science fiction. Hawthorne wrote fantastic science fictions on occasion. Huh? So I went back the next day and took the job. And we went to live in Ireland. My God, we never had any money. Never traveled, never been away from home, never eaten in a good restaurant, huh? And we lived in Dublin for almost a year. And during that year, I turned to Houston one night and I said, "How did I get this job?" I said, "And all the writers in the world, you know, no one knows I exist. Martian Chronicles came out a few years ago, sold 5,000 copies. One or two reviews in the back of books with the obituaries, huh? Yeah. How did I get this job?" He said, "Well, it was that short story of yours in The Golden Apples of the Sun called The Foghorn, about a dinosaur falling in love with the lighthouse. I thought I smelled the ghost of Melville there." And I said, no, John, I was very honest with you when I met you. I had never read Melville. So it remained a mystery. I still, what was there in that story that made him think I was Melville's bastard son, huh? And I did research later into Melville's life, and I discovered the secret, of course, that he had the same midwives I did, huh? He was midwifed by the Old Testament. Moby Dick is full of Old Testament names and characters. And he was midwifed by Shakespeare. Shakespeare he had never read till he was 30 years old. Because books were published in small type 100 years ago. And you couldn't read them if you had bad eyesight. But he went to Boston, found an edition of Shakespeare in large type, and ran amok and wrote to friends saying, "My God, King Lear is my friend. I'm a friend to Hamlet. I know Romeo and Juliet. I know Richard III. Huh?" And he tossed most of his whaling equipment out and overnight almost wrote Moby Dick under the influence of Shakespeare. So these are my midwives, huh? My experience from the age of 7 growing up in the Baptist church, and then Shakespeare when I was 16 in high school. And because of my love of language, huh, my love of metaphor, and the influence of the Greek and Roman myths I read starting when I was 5, huh, and King Tut coming out of the tomb when I was 3, and that wonderful pictures of him in the newspapers of America when I was 3 years old, and I said to my mother, "What's he famous for?" She said, "For being dead 3,000 years. I said, "Wow, that's quite an accomplishment." And so all these metaphors, you see, are what enabled me, plus, it went into that story and it got me the job of writing Moby Dick. Otherwise, if I'd given up on the dinosaurs, if I'd given up on the Old Testament, if I'd rejected Shakespeare, I wouldn't be standing here talking to you today, huh? I'm a solid mass of metaphors, huh? Just waiting to pomegranate forth, huh? Pomegranate forth. I think it's time to quit. I think I'm ahead. And I'll sign books and what have you. Thank you very much.